All right, let's open our Bibles, Psalm 61. The Psalms are a part of that block of studies there, or books of study, called the poetic books or wisdom books. And Psalms in particular, like all of the wisdom books, are not interested in moving history forward. They are very much interested in developing your present tense relationship with God. So there are lots of questions and crying out in prayer and worry and fear and anxiety and not knowing what to do. And God, can you show me? And then there's God, I know that you'll come through. And you get to listen in the Psalms to the prayers of others, many of them written by David, certainly the most prolific of the psalm writers, but there's others as well. And they are meant, I think, in many ways to be devotional for your spiritual life. They're good to read in the mornings. They're good to spend time with during the week. They make it a little bit harder to teach because every 10 verses you change subjects. But that's all right. We can get through that. And we certainly want to learn what the Lord has to say through these things as God gives you insight into wisdom and teaches us our relationship and about our relationship with Him. Tonight, you could call these five Psalms maybe hiding in God's fellowship. They are, most of them, written by David. In fact, maybe all of them tonight are written by David. And they are written at a time when David finds himself either out of the city on the run because his son has led a coup, or you know, at the end of himself, wanting very much to see God work, or just hungry to be back where God is when he has been chased away from the temple and all. But you know, you get to listen to what David has to say, and then see what the Lord might do in applying that to your own life as you walk with Him. Psalm 61 is a psalm that David appears to have written after his boy Absalom had led a rebellion and had been quashed. It didn't take that long, really, for Absalom to be overthrown. David was pretty sure he was going to be able to go back to Jerusalem. If you remember the history, he was staying with an old friend named Barzillai, who was already 80 years old, in a place called Mahanaim, which was on the other side of the Jordan. And he would bring this young man, this old guy, back with him to encourage him, and actually gave his son a place of service. But, you know, David had a lot of mixed feelings. On the one hand, there'd been a rebellion. On the other hand, it was over. On the one hand, his son had been killed. On the other hand, he was free to go serve again. On the one hand, he had brought a lot of this on himself by not dealing with the sins of his sons and of his own life. On the other hand, God had forgiven him. So he was out of danger, and he was being cared for by this fellow Barzillai in regal style. But yet he was away from where God was. You know, the Old Testament is very interesting because the Lord puts his name in one place, right? So you're not free to just run around everywhere and make sacrifices. If you're going to come to the Lord and get as close as you can with the offering, you're going to have to come to Jerusalem. You're going to have to come to the tabernacle at the time, since the temple hadn't been built. That's the only place you can go. And David longed to be there. You know, that is as good as it got in the Old Testament, was to be there. So this psalm is written, short one at that, but with mixed feelings, as David, you know, finds his heart overwhelmed. He's got a lot of things going on in his mind. Things have not gone well. Much of it was self kind of caused. But yet, he trusts that the Lord is going to work, and this isn't the end of the line for him. So he begins in verse 1 by saying, "Lord, hear me. Hear my cry, God, and attend to my prayer." This word cry is a very interesting Hebrew word because it means to scream, and the translation literally is piercing wail. This was not a quiet man of prayer. You know, when you're that emotionally distraught, prayer can come out in all kinds of ways. And David was a man of great emotion, and his heart, like I said, was just devastated over his son being killed. His son had not made peace with God, and David knew that. I think if you will look at the little boy born to him and Bathsheba that the Lord took, and David was fasting, you remember, and praying. When the little child died, he said to the servants, "I know that this boy will not come back to me, but one day I will go to be with him." He knew the future of this little heart that had, you know, never come to that place where he could make a decision. God was going to take that little boy home. When Absalom died, all David could get out was, "I wish it had been me instead of you." No assurance over his life, no, you know, assurance over his future. He had sinned away his days of grace, and David's heart was broken. So David is crying out because though he is in the clear, so to speak, you know, there's been some terrible things that have come as a result. He says in verse 2, Lord, help me. From the ends of the earth, I will cry to you, and when my heart is being overwhelmed, lead me to the rock that is higher than I. For you have been a shelter for me and a strong tower from the enemy, and I will abide in your tabernacle forever, trusting in the shelter of your wings. You know, sorrow is a hard thing to go through. You know, Christians, we always have the hope that it's going to get better. But I think sorrow is worse when you're away from home. You know, when you're just kind of isolated from family or friends or from the things that are familiar to you. And, you know, my son a few years ago when we were in Israel got fairly sick and had to go to the hospital for a week. He had some bug that I think he picked up surfing in Huntington Beach and then took with him. But they said, have you been to Egypt? And he said, no, but I've been to Huntington Beach. And he had this little animal that liked to go after you. And he lost, I think, 20 pounds in 9 days or something. But he was in the foreign place. And it's harder to be sick where you're not used to things, right? David, though he was just a few days away from home and probably could return now, found himself feeling like he was really at the end of the earth. And he uses those words in particular, you know. It's only a 3-day trip home, but he felt like his heart was just overwhelmed. He couldn't find rest in someone else's house. He couldn't find rest out on the road. And so he asked the Lord to help him, to hear him, and then to hide him. Let me come and find my shelter with you. You know, Absalom's threat is gone. But David caused a lot of this. You know, the worst thing I think about sin is not that it can't be forgiven, but what the consequences are when we could have done better. And though God forgives, you know, you can't change the consequences. Lord, I'm weak and I need to stand in your strength. You've been a shelter to me, past tense. You've been a strong tower from the enemy, past tense. I'm going to abide in your tabernacle forever. That's future tense. I know what it means to find my rest with you. I'm going to come and abide. And the word abide in Hebrew there means to permanently reside. As I mentioned, David was an ordinary Israelite in the sense that, not being a priest, he couldn't go into no tabernacle, not very close. He was going to be held away by just all of the things that sin, you know, kept man from God. And yet, David just wanted to be, notice he writes there in verse 4, in the tabernacle, and there where the shelter of his wings were. If you went into the Holy of Holies and over the mercy seat, the Lord had caused them to make these cherubim with wings that just covered this place where the offering was put, where God protected, if you will, you know, where God's presence was. David mentions all of them. He couldn't get that close. You can. But he was troubled by his sin and it had caused such grief. And the only place he thought he could run, and he was right, was to find that peace that only God can give. You know, when all falls apart, David cries out in his end of the earth kind of experiences. You know, what happens to you when you run out of the proverbial rope? Where do you go? You know, and maybe it's intensified when you're the cause of the rope coming to an end. You know, I had a fellow one time come in and he said, you know, the Lord told me to quit my job. And I said, great. He said, I'm here to get help with the rent. I said, I can't help you. And he said, why not? I said, the Lord told me not to. You know, if you're going to really do what you believe the Lord says, then you're going to have to live with the consequence, aren't you? And for David, it had been a horrible experience, these, you know, months of sin that had turned into years of grief. Some people, when they get to the end of the rope, get to drinking again or drugs or just they fight against God. They don't come to the rock, you know. And yet God's desire, it seems to me in the scriptures, if he's going to help you grow, is to constantly push you towards your extremity. He doesn't really want you self-sufficient. So if he can push you towards, you know, having nothing to lean on, then you have a great chance in just leaning on him. And it is at the end of you that God's grace begins. You know, when your endurance fails and your weakness is exposed, then God can begin to pour out grace without limit and love beyond measure and power without any kind of boundary. But God will push you there. For David, not only has he been pushed there, but he has caused some of it as well. I thought about Jacob today, you know. He had had a less than fond farewell for an uncle. He had worked for Laban for years. They didn't trust each other. They were both as crooked as the day was long. And he no sooner got a, "Don't you come back this way, buddy," when he hears that his brother, who 17 years earlier had said, "If I ever find you, I'm going to kill you," is coming to greet him with hundreds of army men, just happy, I guess, to come and visit. And Jacob's mind just goes, "I'm done. I can't go back. I really can't go forward. I'm history." He's got wives and children and herdsmen and, you know, running. He's not by himself. He can't run very fast. You know, he's making a good time 2 miles a day with all of the stuff. And he comes to the end of himself, and you remember the story how he all night wrestles with an angel of the Lord, and what he needed was sleep and rest. He thought, he told everyone to go sit over there while he sat over by himself to try to get some rest. It was going to be a long day the next day. But he got no sleep. God kept him awake. God wrestled with Jacob. And in the morning, as the, you know, and he was no spring chicken, by the way, but he fought good because that's what Jacob did. He fought. And in the morning, when the light came on and the angel said, "Let me go," he said, "I can't. I'm not letting you go until you bless me." And so the angel touched his thigh, and the muscles in his leg dried up, and now he had to walk with a limp. Now he's without sleep, and he's got an inability to even walk fast. But Jacob refused to let go, and through tears of brokenness, according to Hosea, and only Hosea tells you, Jacob asked to be blessed. And the Lord said, "I'll give you a new name. From now on, you won't be the heel catcher, the self-sufficient one. You'll be called Israel, governed by God." And he ran out of ideas. He has no health left. He has no strength left. He has no direction left. He's got to face up to what he had left behind. But he does so under God's, with God's help. And he goes down this new road as a new man. And God does great things with him. Now, he doesn't always do well. He stumbles. Sometimes he acts like Jacob. And the Lord says, "You're Jacob again, aren't you?" And then he has to, "Oh, yeah, I'm Israel. I got to let you do it." Like you, you're a Christian. You're Christ-like. And sometimes you're not. Then you get your old name back. But Jacob did well. And he found out what God could do through him. But Jacob's last cry of desperation was his first cry of victory. And that's oftentimes the way it is, you know, when you run out of ideas. So in many ways, David sits here out of ideas. He wants to find rest at God's feet and in his care and by his heart. And so that's where he determines to go in all of this. His son is dead. The coup has failed. He is going to make it. But he knows, you know, what has caused all of these things. So he turns to rejoice in what God has done. "You, God, have heard my vows," he says. "You've given me a heritage, a future, if you will, an inheritance of those who fear your name." So he begins to rejoice in God's kindness. You know, David's throne had been grabbed by someone else, but God in his goodness had restored it to David. And David was sure he had a future. You know, this was long after the Lord had talked to him about the Messiah coming through his loins and one that would sit upon the throne forever. So when the enemy came to try to overthrow it, you know, David in his heart knew that that couldn't happen because God had given him a heritage, a promise. "And you will prolong the king's life," God's goodness. "His years, as many generations, he'll abide before God forever." He had a great future. David knew he wasn't going to live another generation, but he believed that God's promised one that would come through him, the next one in that line would come, and that God wouldn't fail. And so he hangs on to the spiritual promises of God for the future to overwhelm the present tense sorrow in his heart. "Prepare me," he writes. "He shall abide before God forever. Prepare for me mercy and truth that it might preserve him." That's God's prayer for us. You know, that's God's will. That's David's prayer, I should say, to the Lord. "And then I will sing praise to your name forever and daily perform my vow." I suspect that, you know, by the way, the root word for perform in Hebrew is peace, shalom. And it is always used in that same manner so that when you talk about, you know, doing something because you've promised the Lord, "I'll perform, I'll bring peace to my life because of the vows," I suspect David made a lot of deals with God as he was running across the Jordan. "Lord, if you bring me back, here's what I'm going to do. Things are going to be different. Things are going to change." And now, as a conscientious believer, David is going to do what he promised the Lord, and as a result, his life will be at peace. He'll pay for his sin in consequence, but his life would be lived for the Lord. And he could respond that way in goodness and in mercy, and he knew that. So that's how he's going to respond to the Lord. I'm going to do what you said. I'm going to have peace with God. What a conflict. We read in Psalm 62 that it was a Psalm of David, but it was delivered, notice, to Jeduthun. And we've run into him once before. Jeduthun is another name for Ethan, who was the Levite, and he was from the tribe of Merari, which was one of the three Levite arms, if you will, or families, that were responsible for the temple and for the moving of the tabernacle. In fact, the Merari's were like the heavy work guys. They took the boards, they took the bars, they took the pillars, they took the, you know, they moved stuff. They were the movers, you know. And when the Lord moved, they moved, and they would set things up. But this Jeduthun, or Ethan, came from that group and yet became one of the three worship directors for David, along with Asaph and a fellow named He-Man, which I like his name the best, you know. Is He-Man leading worship today? He certainly is. Oh, it's going to be good worship then, you know. He-Man always played at the men's retreats, I'm sure, you know. Not necessarily Ethan. But you find him in chapter 39 and here, and then I think 70, maybe 76 or 77, a couple weeks from now, you'll see him again. And he's the worship leader that this song was given to that David had written, and maybe he wrote the music to it or just, you know, led the people in it. But here you find David waiting upon the Lord and speaking about learning to wait upon God while the enemy rages. I think that Psalm 62, like several of these others, they're hard to determine what the confrontation was, but it really doesn't matter, because if there's one thing I know Christians are not good at, it's waiting. We're horrible at it, you know? After about 20 minutes, we wonder where God is. I've been praying all morning. I don't get it, you know? Or I've been waiting 2 weeks, or whatever it might be. It doesn't take long to push us over the edge, does it? But I'll tell you what, when you wait, you grow. When God gives you everything, you never grow. You never grow. You just keep filing them. Thank you. I'll put that over here. Yeah, thank you. I'll put that over here. Thank you. I'll put that over here. But waiting, oh man. Well, this is a psalm about waiting, and there's not just one in the scriptures, there's many. But I want you to look very carefully at the words, because, you know, when the enemy is against you, the Lord's supposed to be your strength. And you can find it if you can learn to just wait upon him alone. Verse 1 says, truly my soul will silently wait for God. Note the word silently. From him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation and my defense. I shall not be greatly moved. Now David will use words like truly, only, surely, and the word alone here in a few minutes in verse 5, all of those are the same Hebrew word. It is a word that literally means alone. I'm going to trust in God alone. So whatever David's facing, his determination here, and it's a good one to learn, is that we've got to wait upon God silently. Silently would mean I don't tell anyone else, I don't really bring it up, I don't share my concerns. Let God work it out. That's a hard one, isn't it? Because we usually like to tell people and then see what the Lord will do. David had an army he could have turned to. He had an opposition party that would have stood with him. He could have went to battle. And the constant temptation in crisis for us is to do something, isn't it? What are you going to do? I don't know. What should I? Here's what I think you should do. And no one ever goes, do nothing. Excuse me? Yeah, let's just pray and see what God will do. No. That's irresponsible. Really? Seems to me irresponsible is running out without knowing what God wants you to do. That could get you in worse trouble. But the temptation is don't just sit there, do something. And Satan's advice always seems to be, don't bother praying now, start moving. And God's usual pattern is, wait. But here's the focus. I will wait upon God alone. It limits your options. You know, the Protestant Reformation had a battle cry that God only. At the time, Rome was willing to say to the church, we believe in the inspiration of scriptures, but we don't believe in that alone. We'll add tradition and the proclamation of the saints and the demands of the pope and the views of the church. And they were placed on equal footing with scripture. It wasn't alone. So the Reformation came and they cried out, God alone. Rome was willing to believe in the intercession of Jesus for man, but not alone. We have Mary to pray to. We have the saints to seek after. We have strength to find in the history. It isn't God alone. It isn't belief in him alone. It isn't salvation through him alone. They believed in salvation by grace through faith, but not alone. They added their works. They believed in the headship of Jesus over the church, but not alone. They put someone in between you and God. And so when David writes alone, that's a pretty big word, you know, because Satan would always have us replace the word alone and add to whatever it is that we need to do. I'm going to just trust and wait silently upon God. Only He is my rock and salvation. How long will you attack a man? You shall be slain, all of you, like leaning walls and a tottering fence. They consult to cast him down from his high position. They delight in lies. They bless with their mouth. They are cursing inwardly. David is a man of faith, but he's also a realist, and he knew that his opposition viewed him as weak. And if this is at all during the Bathsheba time, David just was, you know, he had withdrawn from life. He was hiding out. He had quit following the Lord or showing up in public. David knew better, and they thought of him, he was like a tottering fence. One more brick, you know, one more blow, and the guy's going to crash. And they delighted in their perceived, phoning. They delighted to be deceptive. And they lied, and they blessed, but they had a different agenda. And David said, I'm just going to let God handle this. Notice in verse 5, my soul will silently will wait upon God alone. Just what verse 1 says, right? For my expectation is from Him. He only is my rock and my salvation, means my defense. I shall not be moved, and in God is my salvation and my glory. He's the rock of my strength and my refuge. It's in God. So you should trust in Him, he writes. All of you peoples, pour out your heart before Him. God can be a refuge for us. I want you to notice that in verse 6, he quotes what he had written in verse 2, except he removes the words greatly from before the word moved. He said, I won't be greatly moved. But now that he's hanging in there for a while, he goes, I'm not going to be moved at all. So his faith is growing as he's singing his song, isn't it? And that's the way faith usually works, you know. He repeats his own counsel, and then he offers it in verse 8 to us. Look, you can pour out your hearts before God and hide in Him. He'll take care of you. You don't need to go anywhere else or look to anyone else. If I could learn that lesson. Man, if you could learn that lesson, that God would work greatly. I think we'd see a lot more of the Lord working. I think we see a lot less of it because we're so busy trying to help Him out. Are you trusting in the Lord alone? No, I got a lot of stuff going on. I got a lot of plans, a lot of ideas. Well, good luck with those. And when you run out of them, maybe you can get to the word alone. David says in verse 9, surely men of low degree are just a vapor and men of high degree are a lie. Weighed upon the scales, they're altogether lighter than air, literally. So don't trust in oppression. Don't vainly hope in robbery. And if riches increase, don't set your heart upon them. For God has spoken once, and I've heard this twice. Power belongs to God. And to you, Lord, also belongs mercy as you render to each one according to his work. So David had some kind of problems with some big shots and little shots. But weighed in the balances, he saw that they were nothing but hot air. Vapor could be translated hot air. You know, if it's the Absalom thing, it wasn't going to work out. I want you to notice in verse 11 that poetic practice in Hebrews of repetition. If you say once, no twice, and you have that up move, it's one of those poetic emphases for speaking of increase. It's like often. It would be just as good to translate the words, I've often heard this, or I've heard this often. Power belongs to God. It's not a question of the enemy's might. It's the question of God's mercy to his and faithfulness to those who look to him, and he will render to others according to their work. God has a way of coming through. When you trust God, you're not taking a risk. I tell you what, you're taking a risk when you don't trust God. There's no risk in trusting the Lord. It's interesting to me that there are most things in our life that we pray about and seek the Lord about that we really don't care how they turn out. And you'll say, whatever God wants to do, and it sounds like faith, but it's not. What it really means is, I don't care. God does what he wants. But when it comes to like your health, your family, your children, your life, your work, things that have huge impact, all of a sudden you start to care. And then you start to say things like this, well, what if the Lord decides not to do it the way I want? Yeah, what about that? Yeah, what if he does something I really don't want him to do? Yeah, what about that? Well, I don't know what I'll do then. Well, then your trust in the Lord is not there yet because he does all things well. So what are you doing fighting with him? Well, I usually don't care. That's right. And because you don't care, you don't have to, your faith really under the microscope. But once you are pressed to the things that matter, now you're going to have to see how to work it out. And David, in this situation anyway, and because all the other Psalms are different, you know, David has a good day and a bad day. He's just like we are. It's just he writes a lot of songs about them. Today he's having a good day. I'm just going to let God work it out. The wicked, the oppression, the robbers, the liars. You know, I'm not going to get caught up, man. I'm just going to trust the Lord alone. Great Psalm 62. The word alone will remind you of the whole Psalm, I think. In Psalm 63, David, we are reading, wrote this while he was in the wilderness of Judah. Down but not out. And if he is running from the invasion by Absalom, which is about the only time David was down there a lot like that later on in life, David hungered to be back home. And he missed the place of worship. But he was running. So he writes about being down and not out. But you remember what Paul wrote to the Corinthians? Is it 2 Corinthians 4 where he said, we've been pressed in on every side, but we're not crushed. And we are perplexed, but we're not in despair. And we're persecuted, but we're not forsaken. And we've been struck down, but we're not destroyed. We're just hanging in there. Well, David had this really hunger for the Lord here because he was in the wilderness of Judah and not in the tabernacle in Jerusalem. And he says, O God, you're my God, and early will I seek you, and my soul thirsts for you, and my flesh longs for you. Very poetic, isn't it? In a dry and a thirsty land where there's no water. I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory. And because your loving kindness is better than life, my lips will praise you, and I will bless you while I live and lift up my hands to your name. And my soul will be satisfied as with marrow and with fatness, and my mouth will sing praises with joyful lips. And when I remember you on my bed, I will meditate on you in the night watches. Down but not out. And David longs the fellowship, misses the fellowship. I love the words thirsted and long. My personal opinion of the church in America is there's very few Christians that long and thirst. Maybe it's just because we have so much stuff, or we have it so much that we can just kind of take it for granted. But I don't find a lot of hungering and thirsting for God amongst the church so often. You want to find it, but it often seems like everyone's in that dry area, you know, spiritually. And yet David longed to see God's glory. I want to see you work. I want to, at the end of verse 2, I want to see your power at work. When David ran off from Jerusalem when his son was coming with the armies, the two priests were Zadok and Abiathar, and they loved David, and they had picked up the ark because it was still the portable worship place, right? And they took it on staves, and they brought it out to David as he was down on the slopes of the Mount of Olives and said, look, we're going to take God with us. And David kind of looked and he shook his head and he said, you know, if God is with me, he'll bring me back here. But the ark has to stay here. That's where the Lord said to put it. He didn't say we should just take it on vacation with us, you know, or on the run with us. He has to watch over Jerusalem from here. That's where he's put his name. And David prays about seeing the sanctuary. I've looked for you in the sanctuary. I want to get back there. And all he could think about in verse 3 was that God had been so good to him and so precious that even his life without God's grace was of little value. So he began to worship the Lord. Verse 4, he lifts up his hands. It's a difficult situation. Hard to worship when things aren't going well. Singing in verse 5, satisfied in his heart. Been forced to leave everything in the world of value behind, but rather than feel sorry for himself, he begins to find satisfaction with God. That's a wonderful outlook, isn't it? He'd brought much of this on himself. He'd lost nothing in the process as far as his fellowship with God was concerned. That he valued the most. And he even said, I'm not going to lose any sleep over this. If I'm awake, I'm just going to go over your past faithfulness and your comfort and your rest. Verse 7, you have been my help. In the shadow of your wings, same picture again, I'm going to rejoice. And I love verse 8, my soul will follow close behind you and your right hand will uphold me. Isn't that a great verse? Stay close to God, you'll find his delivering power. Close behind you, your right hand upholds me. If you don't feel the Lord holding you up, maybe you're too far away. He just can't reach. No, he can't. But you can't experience, maybe. But those who seek my life to destroy it, They're going to go to the lower parts of the earth and fall by the sword and be a portion for the jackals while the king rejoices in God. And everyone who swears by him will find glory, but the mouth of those who speak lies will be stopped. So David's on the run. He longs to be back in fellowship. He believes that his enemies are doomed and defeated and devoured. And he makes a very interesting comment in verse 10. He said they're going to be a portion for the jackals, or for the wolves, if you will. If you talk to Hebrews even today, there's nothing worse than a body remaining unburied. And what's even worse is if the animals get to it and devour it, and there's no funeral for that dead body. In fact, you might remember that God's great contempt for Jezebel was to let her die in the fields and the wolves devour her. And both Elisha and Elijah in 1 Kings 21 and 24 mention it, that the Lord so was disgraced by their lives, he just let them be eaten by the animal. There was no even funeral. Let's let them be food for the animals. You know, their life had meant nothing in the way that they had lived it. So David concludes as he's running, I'm going to win in the end and stake my claim on God's word. And sometimes, you know, people come in for counseling, and most folks, when they come to church for counseling, they want you to give an answer to their problem in 30 minutes or less. All right, here's the deal. And they'll lay out for you their whole life, and they go, so what am I supposed to do? And they'll look at you like, you better come up with something. You know, I took an hour off of work to come find out from you. And sometimes here's the answer. Well, you just have to wait on the Lord. Excuse me, is Pastor Lyle busy? You know, could I get a second opinion? Because they want, like, that immediate deal. And look at David. David's on the run. He's going to trust the Lord. He's going to run if he needs to. But he's going to rest in God's promises. He's down, but he's not out, because he believes to see God's best. And sometimes if you've done everything you can and you're hungry to see God work, you just have to wait. Psalm 64 has only one focus, the poison tongues of men. And because we've been doing so many of the Psalms, I know this is like the third or the fourth Psalm that has to deal with people speaking about you behind your back. And I thought about that and said, Lord, how come we couldn't just have less Psalms? But you know, God does something very interesting in the Bible. He just repeats himself till we get it. And whenever you find the Lord repeating himself, it isn't because he stutters or because he forgot that he already told you this. But it's always because we're so slow to learn them, aren't we? And we have to be taken right back to the same truth again. And God often repeats it. The lesson about handling those who speak evil is, I think, of particular help in our society, because, you know, talk shows thrive on speaking evil of others. You know, we're getting closer to election year. And that's all you're going to hear, speaking evil of others. That's all that life is, and it's reduced to that. It's hard to say when this was written. I know when Absalom was overthrown, there was a tremendous smear campaign waged against David by the opposition. And maybe that's the setting. Doesn't matter. But listen to what God says about handling that kind of wickedness. David says in verse 1, hear my voice, God, in my meditation, the things I'm thinking about. See what I'm contemplating. Preserve my life from fear of the enemy and hide me from the secret plots of the wicked and the rebellion of the workers of iniquity, who have sharpened their tongues like swords and bent their bows to shoot arrows that are bitter words. And they shoot them in secret at the blameless, and they shoot suddenly and without fear. And they encourage themselves in an evil manner, and they talk of laying snares secretly, and they say, who's going to see them? And they devise these iniquities and have perfected a shrewd scheme, both in the inward thoughts and in the hearts of men, and it is deeply set. So David's first prayer is, Lord, I don't want to be afraid of being afraid, which I think is a pretty cool prayer. David worries about the methods of malice that are being used. I didn't ever see in the Bible David running from a fair fight, but this isn't fair. And David is very concerned, you know. In his day, just like in our day, people love to believe the worst. The church is probably the worst place to see it in, and it's the place you find it most often, the talking, the gossip, the destructiveness. You know, people will repeat a lie long before they find out if it's true. And you can ruin godly reputations and put people out of business with your tongues, you know. And David says in his day, stop them, Lord. They have secret plots and arrows of bitter words, and in secret they shoot at people that don't deserve them. They're innocent, and they comfort themselves in their shrewd ideas, and they're good at it, and they can cover their tracks, and they sharpen their tongues. Very poetic, isn't it? Very picturesque. But boy, it doesn't take much courage to shoot an arrow in secret from afar, does it? It's hard to defend against that as well. People that spread lies and rumors, and I think they're cowards, and it's cruel. And if they can't look in your face and say it, then you probably shouldn't need to hear it. Being a senior pastor, I've had it happen to me a few times. People get angry and they go to work on me, or usually not to my face. I'm usually big enough for that, but behind your back, or to my wife, or to the kids, or to an elder, or to a board. Oh, you know, that pastor. Oh, Lord. I must tell you, it used to bother me. I don't care anymore. My favorite joke is, what you said would bother me if I cared what you thought. And that's not necessarily honest, but you can't live your life looking to please people. You've got to please the Lord, as best, and do the best that you can. And when you work with people, people are problems, aren't they? I think there was a pastor that trained me who said to me, you're going to love the ministry. You're just not necessarily going to like all the people. And I thought, well, ministry without people doesn't exist. The people are the ones you have to serve, but they also are the greatest problems because sin is within us and the enemy looks to devour, and the church is God's work. So, David finds himself fearful. Preserve my life from fear, he says in verse 1. I don't want to worry about what people are saying or even be afraid of what they might think. That's a good prayer. And ministry is like that. David wouldn't have had this problem if he hadn't stepped up to serve. He even writes in verse 6, this wickedness runs deep to the core of these folks' life. They live to destroy. But I want to trust the Lord. Be careful that you never become one shooting, an arrow to wound others. Your words can destroy. And the enemy, I think, will use it greatly. And it's much, if you really got a problem with somebody, go find them, talk to them. The Bible's pretty clear on how you deal with it. Go do that. I don't think I've ever had a problem. People knock on my door going, hey, dude, I got to talk to you. I think you're an idiot. Because I am. So that's, thank you. I knew that. Thank you for affirming my self-opinion. But when you hear it from others, who's got time for that? Those people are cowards. And they're not being led by the Spirit of God, certainly. And David prayed it. He went through it. They shoot suddenly. They're not afraid to just speak evil. It's in their hearts. They lay snares secretly. They don't think anybody will ever find out, But David looks at them through God's eyes and says in verse 7, God shall shoot at them with an arrow and they'll be wounded. He'll make them stumble over their own tongues. And all who see them will flee away, and all men will fear and declare that the work of God. They shall wisely consider his doing, because the righteous shall be glad in the Lord and trust in him, and the upright in heart shall glory. So, there's nothing better than seeing God straighten things out, is there? Ask the church in the days of Ananias and Sapphira. By the way, when they dropped dead in the church door, there were very few problems with hypocrisy for a while. No one told fibs. Wink, wink, nod, nod, cross my finger, hope to die. Nobody messed around, man, because you could die. A few people dropped dead, it'd straighten me right up, wouldn't it you? So better that you just keep your eye on the Lord, because he'll have the last word, and he'll win the battle, Better that we just rest. I remember reading a couple of months ago about the Battle of Waterloo. I was looking about some stuff up on the Duke of Wellington, but you might remember he was fighting Napoleon. And there was really no way that Napoleon could lose, except that that German-Prussian guy, Van Blücher, came. He brought some armies, and Wellesley won the battle. And he was given the victory, the Duke was. And so, in England, across the English Channel, you didn't have radios necessarily, but they had the semaphores, the flags that would send the messages. And like most of the days in England, very, misty and cloudy or foggy. And all they could get across the water was Wellington defeated. And the people wept and, oh, man, we just knew now we're done. Napoleon's coming. But in the morning when the fog lifted, the whole message said Wellington defeated Napoleon. And the place just went berserk and the bells rang and the nation sang and everybody had a day off of work, Well, it's kind of like that for us, You go to Calvary and you hear the words, Jesus defeated. until Sunday. And then you read Jesus defeated Satan. And then you get the whole story. Well, here's David. You know, he's in the thick of being spoken about and wickedly so. But he wants to read the whole message. So he gets to the end and he says the righteous are going to be glad and blessed and God's going to speak and he'll fix it. You know, when the poison flies from the tongues of men, God has yet to have the final word, but he'll have the final word. Better you just trust the Lord. I just want God to speak well of me. Don't you? You want to hear, well done, good, faithful sir. And finally, chapter 65. And from the context, it appears that David would write this song of great rejoicing at a time when the land was bringing in the harvest. I think from a prophetic standpoint, it always, when you find these blessings to come, speaks of when the Lord comes to rule and the enemy is defeated and his government is established upon the earth. But he writes in verse 1, praises awaiting you, God, in Zion. And to you the vows will be performed. O you who hear prayer, and to you all flesh will come, and iniquities prevail against me. As for our transgressions, you will provide atonement for them. Great word. Blessed is the man you choose and cause to approach you, that he may dwell in your courts and be satisfied with the goodness of your house and of your holy temple. David looks ahead and sees a day when man can seek God who hears prayer. You know, in the Old Testament, the first question after the fall of man was God saying, where are you? The first question found in the wise men in the New Testament is, where is he? Man was hiding, God was seeking. But for God seeking man to man seeking God, both are brought together. Now notice the Lord hears prayer and man can come. And the question of sin is immediately brought up. And God will provide. I love the fact that the closer you get to the Lord, the worse your sin looks and the better God looks. Don't you think? I think about Peter in the boat when he finally realized after the big catch that Jesus was more than a man, he was God. The first thing he said, Lord, get out of the boat. Get out of the boat. I'm a sinful man. I don't want you near me. I shouldn't have you by me. And the Lord broke through to Peter. So here, praise is waiting for you, God. You're the one who hears prayer, and iniquities prevail against me and our transgressions, but you'll provide as we come atonement for them. And you'll choose man and cause us to approach you so we can dwell in your courts and be satisfied in your house. That's unbelievable insights for an Old Testament vision, isn't it? If you go through the Jewish feast days, there's the Feast of Trumpets, the Lord comes. Then there's the Feast of Atonement, if you will, the Lord forgives. And then there's the Feast of Tabernacles, the Lord comes to rule. You know, the golden age follows. So even the feasts themselves kind of took it in that order. We read in verse 5, by awesome deeds and righteousness, you'll answer us. Now notice he calls them, O God of our salvation. You who are the confidence of all of the ends of the earth and of the far off seas. You who have established the mountains by your strength and clothed them with your power. You who still the noise of the seas, the noise of their waves, the tumult of the people. They also who dwell in the farthest parts are afraid of your signs. You make the outgoing of the morning and the evening rejoice. You visit the earth watering it, you greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You provide grain, and so you've prepared it. The water, its ridges abundantly settling its furrows, making it soft with showers, blessing its growth. Thus this harvest prayer. You crown the year with your goodness, the paths drip with your abundance. They drop on the pastures of the wilderness, and the little hills rejoice on every side. The pastures are clothed with flocks, the valleys covered with grain, they shout for joy. They also sing. God's provision. But notice it starts with the words, man wants to come to you who hears prayer, but sin prevail and transgressions. And then if you'll forgive him and bring him into your courts, that's because you're an awesome God of salvation. How do we know you now? By the blessings you bring upon our life. And David writes from his life as an agricultural kind of guy, you know, as a shepherd, he saw the hand of God at work constantly. Next week, 66 through 70, please continue to read ahead. I think there's a long one in there. 69 is a long psalm, so you will study, won't you? Father, thank you tonight as we sit together for the blessings of being able to come every Sunday evening together as a body and open your word and just allow you to teach us and speak to us through it. And Lord, tonight as we sit together and we contemplate, you know, your words to us through these songs, I pray that you might drive home to us whatever it is that we need to hear. We get so many chances to hear your voice, one psalm after the other. We think about David, so mixed in his feelings there in Psalm 61. He felt like he was at the ends of the earth. He was at the end of his rope. And yet he turned to you. He responded to you. He rejoiced in your goodness and in your kindness. We think about Psalm 62, Lord, and we just write that word waiting across it. Lord, teach us to wait upon God and to wait upon him alone. Father, how often and how quick we are to run to our friends for help and to our neighbors for assistance and to our family for support. And we aren't so keen upon just keeping it to ourselves and seeing what you'll do. We're not too good at waiting upon God alone. But may we be reminded this week, Father, that you have great work to do. In Psalm 63, Lord, as we find David far removed from the place of worship, hungering to go back there. And I pray that you would give to our church and to the saints here in America a fresh hunger for the things of God. That it wouldn't be this forced march to church or forced habit of Bible studies. We'll want to be here. We'll want to learn. We want to be exposed to what your Spirit would want to do in us. And we could worship and raise our hands and hunger after the things of God, even as David so thirsty. May you remind us from Psalm 64, Lord, that when men raise up with wickedness, that God, you have the last word, and we should allow you to speak that word rather than being fearful of what man might say or do. May we rather, Father, allow you to be the God that will shoot the arrows back and make men stumble over their own tongue so that others will see and flee. I know, Lord, that you want to do much more in our lives than we often will allow you because we're so self-sufficient. And faith is so hard to walk by. And works are so much easier when they don't have to be based in faith. But may you stir us up through your word tonight to finally come to Psalm 65 and see that the God who hears prayers has also provided our atonement. And you have called us to yourself so that we may dwell in your courts and be satisfied. And be a holy people. If tonight you don't know the Lord, that's certainly God's invitation to you. That you would come to him and believe in him and find life. That's God's greatest desire. He made you to have fellowship with you, but our sin has separated us from God. But the Lord has sent his Son to remove our transgression. And he that is the creator of all, to whom all flesh will come, we'll find man prevailed against by iniquities, but yet God providing an atonement. The Lord in his Son can give you life tonight if you'll come and seek him. Come and receive him. Come and ask him for life. And watch what God will do with you once you surrender to him your life. Maybe you're at the end of your rope. It's a good place to jump into God's arms because he will carry you and see you through.
Well, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and rating our podcast. You can visit us on the web at morningstarcc.org and on our YouTube channel at morningstarcc. Again, that's at morningstarcc. If you'd like to support this podcast, please look us up at patreon.com/morningstarcc. Again, that's Patreon, patreon.com/MorningstarCC.